You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show, considered the hottest podcast in the universe by Martians. Now get ready for the heat. Here's Brian Callen.
Okay, everybody, this is The Brian Callen Show. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible, and you can go to audiblepodcast.com/BCS, which stands for The Brian Callen Show, and you will get a free audio download. You can get a free book to download. I would recommend, I'm listening right now to John Irving's A Widow for 1 Year. Talk about one of the great American writers. He's also my wrestling coach in high school for a little while because his son, Colin Irving, wrestled on my team and his son was amazing. But that's neither here nor there. He is a hell of a writer, man. He writes long books, but they are a little bit life-changing. So I recommend that. It's narrated by a guy named George Gigal. I mean, they get some great narrators. And I really think there's a huge difference between reading and listening to a book. It takes longer to listen to it, but man, you get everything out of it, especially if it's read by a good actor like George Gigal. So get your free download today. Go to audiblepodcast.com/BCS. And if you like it, email me. And if I like your email and I like the book you're recommending and the way you say it, I'll talk about it on the air. Okay? Well, folks, 2013. I'm actually recording this a day after New Year's. And my New Year's resolutions? Well, I guess probably learn, laugh, and fuck more. In that order, by the way. I don't think there's anything else. I really don't. I mean, you know, there's so much to learn, but learn the right way. I think it's a good thing to do is kind of go think about yourself when you're 90 and think about what you wish you'd done. My only fear is regret. That's all I want to do. I've already done the other stuff. I skydived. You know what? Big deal. You're falling through the air. You know, I mean, some people get off on that thrill and that's fine. It's just not for me. It's hard to argue. It's hard to get a bigger thrill than when you're on stage and you got a bunch of people laughing at you and you're trying new jokes. That's that's a thrill for me. Or when I take my shirt off and I look at myself in the mirror and I'm like, what the, do I even age? And I'm like, and then I look at myself and I go, you still got it, kid. You still got it. And then I slowly lower my pants and I usually break into song, which is interesting and surprising. The podcast you're about to hear, of course, is my father, and I have him tell some really kind of great stories about when he was in Iwo Jima, and he took a tour there as a former Marine. That's pretty wild. But before that, I thought I'd just kind of, I'm going to start dropping in with little anecdotes and stories and points of view on things. You know, we're headed for this fiscal cliff, and I talked to my father about it. You know, the bottom line is government is very is stalemated right now, but that may not be such a bad thing. Maybe it's a good thing that everything is paralyzed in Washington and we can go about our lives. I don't know. I don't really, you know, it's hard to really think about stuff you have no control over. You know what I mean? It's weird when you have a government you feel doesn't track the will of the people. You end up just doing your own thing. And we're lucky enough in this country to be able to do that. I was thinking about what I think about every day. You know what I think about? I wake up and I go, oh, I'm going to make a cappuccino. I'm going to see if I can get it exactly right. I read an article about how to make the perfect coffee, the perfect espresso. Talk about a new world problem, man. What is wrong with me? I'm literally like packing the beans down just so. And then I steam the milk to 135 degrees. They say you're supposed to get a thermometer. I can't do it. I can't go get a thermometer and steam my milk to 135 degrees because I wouldn't hang out with that guy. It's the kind of guy I kind of want to throw in a flying headlock. And now I'm becoming the guy I want to throw in a flying headlock. So you can't be that particular. But I have a smell test. You're supposed to boil the milk just when the sugars begin to, I guess, granulate so the milk gets to its optimal sweetness, the sugars in the milk. And so that's kind of what I do. I know this is fascinating to you guys. And then you have to pack the beans down, like the ground beans in the espresso, you know, container, just so that the water flows through it evenly. Ha! Kill me, ladies and gentlemen. But you know what? I make a mean cappuccino. So that's what I think about. I wake up and I go, I'm going to have a great cappuccino, and I'm going to get it so it tastes chocolatey and nutty. And I do. And then I have some deer meat and some blueberries. And sometimes some oatmeal with bananas. Yeah, energy-rich food. Where do I get deer meat? Oh, I don't know. I shot it in Montana like a man. By the way, Joe Rogan and I are going to go out to Alaska, I think, and plug some caribou. I just want to shoot like something like twice a year so I have fresh game meat in my freezer year-round. Does that make me a bad person? It makes me feel strong. I'm buying a bunch of mats and I'm turning my garage into a dojo. I think about that. That's the other thing I think about. So I think about what I'm going to eat, what I'm going to drink in the morning. Then I think about jujitsu, and I haven't been rolling, and I haven't rolled in a long time, but my buddy was an international Greco guy, and he's going to take me through some stuff. So I'm buying a bunch of mats, turning my garage into a dojo, and I'll be rolling and practicing throws and how to protect yourself against elbows and punches. You know, stuff that you really need, you know, in real life. You know, in case I get thrown up against a cage, I'll know how to react. I'm an idiot. It's funny. It's all simulation. I do stuff that I'll never have to really use in real life. I don't know. The reason I don't smoke weed or do drugs or even drink much is I don't have time in my head. I feel like I got to keep as much headspace clear. And that's my lesson to all you for 2013. Just be specific about what you want to do. I mean, get detailed about it. I think it helps. Every time I ask somebody, what do you want to do? They go, I don't know. I don't know. Well, if you don't know, then you're going to get, I don't know. But try to be specific about what you want to do, even if it's something small. Just get good at something. Or it, not even getting good is not even the point. If you're reaching for good, usually that's enough to keep you going. Because, man, time flies. I'm going to be 46 in January. That's 4 years away from 50, all right? And once again, I look so fucking good. Take my shirt off here. Yeah, there it is. There it is. Am I supposed to have these squares in my stomach? And those obliques are so pronounced. Just from years of twisting my body as I drive my fist into my opponents. I'm not a fighter, but I want a fighter's body. Although Nick Diaz, you know, one of my favorite fighters, he doesn't necessarily look like a fighter. Nick Diaz looks kind of like a dude who works, you know, at the mall, but who does some lifting once in a blue moon. And yet he'll crush you. He's going to fight GSP. Make a prediction right now. As much as I love Nick Diaz, I love that guy. I think that GSP is just, he's too good a wrestler and probably a little too strong. He just always wins, but I don't care. All right, well, that's kind of, I just wanted to go through what's on my mind. I hope it was really enlightening. I hope you realize that I'm as big a fool and an idiot as most people. And I hope that this year I can get as many listeners as possible. I'm going to try to book some amazing guests, Sugar Ray Leonard included. And before we get into my father here, I just want to say that I'm going to be at the Punchline in San Francisco this January 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th. The Punchline San Francisco. And then I will be at the Vancouver Comedy Mix January 24th, 25th, 26th. Come and see me. Out. I am here with the great Mike Callen, who to date is our most popular guest as far as downloads are concerned. And boy, I wish you could see his face because he's so excited. He's literally looking at his watch and rolling his eyes. We just spent Christmas together. It was very touching and moving. Thanks for you got me a flat screen TV, and I appreciate that. I bought you a scarf and a hat, and I guess the hat doesn't fit your enormous head.
You've been looking at my head for 45 years, and you can't see that it was made for an extra large?
Well, I mean, I knew it was extra large. I thought I got an extra large, and it turns out it was a large.
Yeah.
You wouldn't.
I mean, it's a nice hat.
Would you wear a cap like that?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm gonna
when
get
you're
you
around. Yeah, of course. I'll.
And by the way, so you should know, Father, a lot of my act is about you. There's a mythical version of you that I developed that's based, you know, a little bit
mythical
on truth.
Mythical in the sense that it says things about my prowess.
Well, you and I grew up very differently. You grew up, you know, in Wisconsin. You went to the Marines at a very young age. To get the hell out of your hometown. I think you learned very quickly you didn't want to be part of that, whatever it was that you came from. You knew there was something bigger out there for you. And then you went to the Philippines. And then how many countries would you say you've been to in your life?
Well, I've been to, it would be up over 100, right? Because Citigroup, when I was running it, was everywhere, and then I had access to a private airplane, a private jet, and you'd always like to wave the flag and come in as a senior guy. So it's got to be over 100. Almost all the African and Latin American countries, and obviously Europe.
Didn't you go to Zaire, which is now the Congo, and you were going to have a meeting with Mobutu, and he was with one of his girlfriends or something, and he canceled the meeting?
Yeah, that's something you come to expect. There's no surprise in that kind of thing. Yes, in fact, that is what happened.
And dealing with countries that were dictatorships, military dictatorships, even if they were friendly with the United States, and oligarchies and monarchies, which you did in the Middle East, must have, because you saw it firsthand, must have shaped your political philosophy, or was it already you were already a believer in democracy?
Too many people talk about world event situations and don't take any of the context into account. Most of my formative years when I was doing all this traveling, we were engaged in a war with the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc nations, and for a good part of it, China as well, until Nixon expertly, along with Henry Kissinger, split them apart, which was incredibly smart. One of the diplomatic coups of
the Sino-Soviet, 20th century.
We thought we had the Sino-Soviet bloc as one communist monolith, and it never happened to be true. And Nixon was smart enough to realize that. But set that aside, when you had the Soviets in the Middle East trying to exploit every opportunity they could, and ever since the post-war period, including in Greece, where Greece was almost lost to the Soviet sphere of influence, if you were an American policymaker, that was the context in which you were working. When the Soviet Union collapsed, which, by the way, nobody saw coming, especially critics on the left who kept claiming that they had this social structure we should really aspire to. And when they collapsed, all these relationships with these various unseemly groups became visibly unsustainable because of the nature of their internal regimes and so forth. But you didn't have the luxury of that call when the Soviet Union was in existence, and you had to use what you had, which in our case was a set of social values, and following on from that, productive wealth that the world clearly looked at.
Well, a lot of people don't realize that, you know, as far, you can go back to 1985 when a lot of listeners were born, and half the world was living under communist and military dictatorships.
And it looked like it was increasing, especially in Central and Latin America.
That's right. In Central and Latin America were controlled by military dictatorships. But certainly, what people forget is China, and we went there. I remember seeing everybody wearing the exact same blue uniform on bicycles. I remember that so well.
That was your political education.
That's right. And then we went to the Soviet Union in 1989, I think. No, I'm sorry, 85. And again, you know, you didn't see any advertising. It was, the people were truly enslaved. They had nowhere to go. And so what people forget is as recently as the 1980s, most of the world was essentially living under oppressive totalitarian regimes. They did not have representative government. But that brings me to my next question, which is, I think the Soviet Union has done better, but I think the Soviet Union has some real problems because they're still run by a gangster squad. And unless you're, you know, tied up with the KGB or what was the KGB and Putin's gang, you can forget it. You know, you're just another serf. That's part of Russian history, and it's to their detriment because what they have is oil and mineral resources that, you know, they can kind of stay afloat with. But my question to you is, we hear a lot of people kind of calling in this country to emulate a lot of the institutions and a lot of the behavior that the Western Europeans have adopted. And I'm speaking specifically of, you know, higher taxes, and I'm speaking specifically of just sort of a more of a socialist mentality, a one-payer healthcare system and things like that. It seems to me that this has not worked out for Western Europe. Western Europe, including France, with their socialist president who's calling to tax people who make $1 million or more. They want to tax them 75% of their income. 75%, so that means 3/4 of your day you're working for the government, not for yourself. It seems to me that formula is not working for Western Europe. It seems to me that Western Europe is in a crisis, and I don't know or see how they're going to get out of it, and I'm sure they will, but I wanted to
see. Well, an interesting point to make at this stage is that we will be the highest tax country as of January 1st in all of Europe. Europe has seen the folly of this and brought taxes down on the productive part of the economy a long time ago. Europe is divided into two, every one of their societies, and there are different proportions. Greece, as I'll mention in a second, is too far on one side. Germany is not. There's a lot of myth about Europe. You're right about France, and there's a very good survey in the London Economist, which is, by the way, one of the best sources of analysis of the United States and Europe you're ever going to find. But the point is, there's a productive sector, which is almost invariably the private sector. Germany, France, Portugal, Spain, Italy in particular. There isn't any government hand laid on all the Italian fashion that comes out of that country that we sort of slavishly follow. Some of their heavy industry has got heavy government influence, I'm sorry, but they are not big exporters. The heavy industry in Germany that exports to the world because of the quality they produce has nothing to do with the government. And then they have this long tradition of socialism on the other side. So what they say is the productive part of the society has to provide the wherewithal, the wealth, so that nobody in the society fails.
Right.
And you can get by with that for a while, and they're in fact very proud of it, and you could have an intelligent debate on that subject. The problem where I think that model breaks down is what you just mentioned. Does it have legs for the long run? And the answer, in other words, through the economic cycles of downturns, upturns, can the state sector be at all productive and provide the kind of services at a level and at a cost that the private sector does? And almost everywhere you look, where you see big government, you see slow growth. It's very hard to find a difference there, to find any. And the public sector in all of these places you just mentioned, their hospital system, their healthcare system, they almost all have next to it, if you want to have it, a private sector. You can go to a private doctor in London in the UK. You can go to a private hospital in London in the UK. You're going to pay full freight.
Right, right. Well, that brings me then to the fiscal cliff and this whole you know, deadline, this looming deadline. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, the Republicans are going to lose. There's no possible way for any other outcome, and they're just posturing at this stage in Congress to try to pretend that they have some kind of leverage, and they have none. Because the president is simply saying, hey, all I'm talking about are people over a certain wealth level, which the vast majority of people can only dream about. So he's saying we want to increase taxes on them. Now, a serious argument is, what does that do to the productive side of the economy? See, what's happening?
To be fair, I don't think Obama's tax hike from a percentage point of view is that high. I think, in fact, it goes back to what the Clinton tax rates were before the Bush tax rates came into play. So it isn't. I think it goes from 35% to 38%, or it might 30, be 37.
39.6.
Well, that may be 39.6, but I think there's going to be a compromise there. So I can live with 2-3%.
But that isn't the issue. That isn't the issue at all, because that argument will always be won by those who say, hey, a couple of percent. And by the way, first some facts. The Obamacare 3.8% tax kicks in January 1st. I've done an analysis. My tax rate will go from about 35 to 44. That's a huge bite.
Yeah.
And if you're a small business, the same thing happens to you who are employing people. Now, there's no body of economic knowledge that says that can be good for the economy. And that's the one thing in this country everybody's agreed on. If you raise taxes on everybody like that, it can't be good. It's going to be a bad thing, because a restrained fiscal policy does damage to the economy. The argument here is that is really meaningful is Mr. Obama has brought the percentage of government as a percentage of GDP from 21% to 24%. And you can take to the bank.
Explain that to listeners, what that means. Explain what, when people say, well, it's the percentage of our GDP that government takes up is 21%, now it's 24. What does that mean?
Let's put numbers on it. The United States has an annual gross domestic product, which means the total value of goods and services produced by the entire economy. Right. It has a number of 14.5 trillion.
Being everything from commodities to the pants.
Everything,
you wear.
Every bit of economic activity in the country, including government. There are several ways of measuring it, but several ways of looking at it. But let's just use a number of $14.5 trillion. Traditionally, this country has had the government part of that between 18% and 20%. Obama has taken it up to 24%. What does that mean? Three things. First thing is, and there are very few people that argue this anymore, amazingly, the government sector is very, very unproductive and inefficient. That's not because the people in government are bad people and those in the private sector are good people. It's because of the incentive structure, nothing else.
That's right.
I have been in the private economy all my life, and the competition is ferocious. Who benefits from the competition? The consumer.
Theoretically. In other words, we'll get to what's wrong with our economy.
We can talk about that later,
economy.
And we'll look at it.
But I understand what you're saying.
But if you want to be a consumer in any country in the world, it's this one times 10 versus any other. Because this is the one country in the world that is structured in its regulation and everything else to benefit the consumer. In many countries, you're structured to benefit the producer. And that's a disaster. And I've lived in countries like that. That's the first thing. So you're shifting resources to the very unproductive from the productive sector. Now, I've said this on this podcast before. It is such a startling conclusion that I think it's appropriate to say it again. The Fortune 500 that was first listed in 1955, fewer than 60 of those left. I keep asking people, what is a government agency that ever went out of business? Somebody recently caught me by surprise and said the House Un-American Activities Committee, that was a congressional committee.
That was Joe McCarthy, yeah.
First of all, that's not part of the executive branch, which is not what I had in mind. And that's a pretty poor record.
Yes, it is.
I mean, if you're in government and they set up a temporary agency to help flood victims, you have one objective, not to go out of business.
Well, ethanol as a fuel source has turned out to be a disaster. It's not even clean.
You cannot stop the subsidies.
Yeah, you're not getting rid of ethanol even anymore. Getting rid of ethanol anymore because
it's not going to happen.
No, because you got 13
so many
plants.
Vested interest and they go to their congressmen.
Well, that brings me to
I said there were three things.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
All right. So the one is you're shifting resources from the one to the other, and that's the wrong way for them to go. It's the reason the United States has had a much higher standard of living. Number two is you are giving power to people who don't compete for a consumer's vote every day. You're giving power to political people who are using this massive amount of resource they now have to distribute it on the basis of a number of criteria, none of which serves the average person in the United States. And I'll even admit quickly to being a part of this program, and you're going to bring it up a little later, where you go to Congress, you go and see a senator or a representative, and what you talk about in terms of why you want some largesse from the government has nothing to do with general values for the people at large. You have to realize that congressmen and senators don't mean what they say when they give speeches. They don't mean what they say.
Yeah.
And if you go to Congress and you see some guy up there making a speech and nobody else is in the chamber, all he is doing is building a little promo for his reelection back home.
That's right.
So they see him.
But see, that really becomes when people say, well, what do you want from your president? I think a great leader should be a man of ideas, a man who has ideas, grand ideas.
That brings us to the third thing. Government, by its nature, is long on intent, the speeches, the inaugural address, the State of the Union address.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States, all of that.
Yeah.
It's just meant for Hollywood. And it's just meant for the kinds of things that you want spectaculars. You want to grab people's attention and so forth. So there's long lists of intentions. We're going to eliminate poverty. We're going to eliminate our energy dependence on foreign countries. We are going to build an education system second to none. Do you know how long those statements have been made? And out of those statements come these building the Department of Education, building the Department of Energy, the Department of Agriculture. Agricultural prices have come down every year since the war. I see no reason they should stop. When we built the Department of Agriculture, we were short of food. Now we have a surplus of food. Just go to any American restaurant and see the obesity around. Is there a reason for the Department of Agriculture? I don't think so. Mm. So and I've gone through this with you before.
Well, the Department of Agriculture exists to give farmers who don't need it subsidies, like craft.
To not grow. Now, the purpose of that would never be created today if it hadn't been created a long time ago. So nothing ever goes away. Now, how about, and what I'm getting to is long on intent and short on results. We still talk at the last presidential election about energy independence, just like we did when we created the Energy Department under Lyndon Johnson, way before almost anybody listening to this was born. But I remember it well. I was in my early 20s. Jimmy Carter came along, and the Department of Education, we got to have the best. These giant bureaucracies grow every year, absolutely every year. Some people argue the same thing for the Department of Defense. Every year they get bigger and bigger, and they become organisms that exist independent of any executive authority. I talked to a president, not in office anymore, and I asked him a question I said, Mr. President, because, you know, even when they're out of office, they have to be addressed that way. I said, Mr. President, what was the biggest surprise that you ever encountered in taking this job, which everybody knows who you are? And so you walk into that office.
I bet I know what he said.
Go ahead.
He probably said, how little I can do.
I have no power.
That's what I thought. That's what I heard Arnold Schwarzenegger say to me. He said, it's amazing how little power you have when you run the seventh biggest economy in the world. You're the governor, and you have no power.
You're none. What can you do?
Yeah.
That's why people come out with these ideas.
Obama's, if you're going to take Obama to task, Obama came to the table. His speeches were all about taking on the special interests in Washington that are essentially representing huge corporate interests, concentrations of power. We have a republic, a government that no longer tracks the will of the people in some instances, and it seems to be getting worse. And Obama is very, very aware of that and came to the floor and said, I want to take on these special interests. I'm going to make this an economy that is responsible to the people. And then he surrounded himself, whether it was intentional or unintentional, with a bunch of people who were government bureaucrats who were very good at this game. You know, and guess what? It's only gotten worse.
But neither one of us could name a president who didn't say that and didn't do the same thing.
Well, of course. I mean, they were talking about in Wall Street. My God, when after the financial industry brought this country to its knees, and there were other factors involved, but in 2009, I think the 16 or 19 largest banks, the investors and managing directors of those banks made more money than they ever did. So a lot of compensation isn't tied to results. A lot of the legislation that was pushed through by, you know, I guess Summers, Lawrence Summers and Mark Raquel, who was that libertarian back in the day, all these guys, was New Deal legislation that had been that had worked for 40 years or 30 years. And but it's very difficult to take on concentrated lobbying efforts with that much money when Wall Street pools its resources and gets organized against a single enemy. It's very difficult to do anything in a country where you have those kinds of forces manipulating government to get what they want, to give themselves an unfair advantage in the marketplace. That's my problem. That's what I think our biggest threat is the fact that these people are not living in a real marketplace.
Forget the finance industry, because I was in it. Not forget it. We can include it.
Yeah.
Any industry. If you don't have representation in Washington, you're dead.
I know that. But isn't there something wrong with that? Isn't at the end of the day...
What's wrong with that, going back to a point 5 minutes ago, is government's gotten too big. You cannot be in business in the United States of America
without a lobbyist.
Without representing yourself in Washington,
exactly.
Or you'll die.
Now, that's crazy.
Now, I took over a company that was in some kind of trouble, but just very briefly, what it did was the largest in the United States to guarantee municipal debt. There are 88,000 different entities that issue debt that are municipal, school,
water
boards.
Explain to people what debt means. What do you mean by that?
Loans. Bonds. They need money to be able to build a sewer, to build a school, maintain school and all that. So there's a vast market in the United States to municipal debt.
That will 88,000 entities. So they'll lend a city money to build infrastructure or something.
Well, the market itself, the people out there buy municipals.
Yeah.
I buy municipals. But the problem is with 88,000 different entities, nobody knows who's what. And so,
you're saying there are 88,000 different companies that do this. That
not
actually,
companies. They are 88,000 municipal entities.
Oh, so 88,000 municipalities, like cities and counties, that issue
and their constituent
bonds.
Units. I mean, you have a dormitory authority, for example, that issues debt to build a dormitory that's connected to a university. You have the city of Stockton.
They say basically, for you guys listening, what they'll say is if they have to build a dormitory connected to the university, they'll say, hey, buy this bond, and it's basically an IOU. So they say, give us $50 today, and we'll give you $75 tomorrow, kind of thing.
Well, they have an interest rate on it. And by the way, the interest rate is tax exempt, and that has been abused. So a municipality can do the following. A municipality can build a baseball stadium. And almost all the baseball stadiums in the country have worked this way.
Yeah.
So a major league team comes and says, we'll come to your town. Isn't that a great thing? And the mayor of Nashville or something says, oh, that's wonderful. They say, but you've got to build us a stadium of $65,000. And it's got to be these number of luxury suites, and it's got to be all these concession stands and all that. The mayor will go out and say, we'll do that. And they will issue bonds to the marketplace through Wall Street. That's what Wall Street does. And they will get the money to build the stadium, and all of the interest on those bonds is tax exempt. They don't pay federal taxes on it. The people that earn the interest, like me,
wow,
I don't have to pay any federal
taxes.
Well,
that sounds like a pretty good
and
thing.
And it's for a baseball stadium. So, I mean, you know, is that what the original intent was?
No.
I don't think so. But I want to make another point. I want to emphasize a point. When I took over this company in January of 2008, I had no notion, because I'd been out of active business for a while, I had no notion of how much time I would have to spend in Washington. I was down in Washington every week. I was seeing household names, senators, and representatives. One little anecdote about that, which you can draw your own conclusions from this. I go in to see a senator. He's on television all the time and so forth. Thank you very much for your time, Senator. I just wanted to bring to your attention this and that about AMBAC. It's all pretty well laid out what you're going to say. You've got a half an hour, never more. You had to get your appointment 3 weeks ahead of time. There are people in the room behind you. We get into about the 25th minute. And he said, Mr. Kellen, I've enjoyed this discussion very much. By the way, a little embarrassing, but what is AMBAC?
Yeah. He didn't know what your company was even.
He didn't know what it did. He didn't know anything about it. Now, I don't blame him. Yeah. But that is what you're dealing with. So the only thing you can do, and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are these mortgage guarantee companies that were set up by the government back in the 70s and went bankrupt, the only thing that you can do is come to them and say, and we're going to support you in your reelection campaign. So the incumbent has an enormous advantage.
Of course.
And his challenger, I'm not going to go and give his challenger some money and tick off the incumbent.
Yeah.
Nobody else is either.
Yeah, that's why it's hard to defeat an incumbent as somebody who's there, because it's...
And by the way, AMBAC, to take that example, they have enemies up there. They have other people go and see these guys.
Yeah.
Saying, AMBAC, you got to crush him. You got to throw him out of business. Because they have a self-serving interest in it. So what am I supposed to do? Not go to Washington because the seams kind of see me?
It's not. Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's not special interest. It's the incentive structure. It's the way government is set up. And whenever you give any central authority a great deal of power, this is not a right or left argument. It shouldn't be. Anytime you give a central authority a great deal of power, you're going to lose your freedoms. That's not because the people in power are bad people. It's just the nature of the beast. So that's what I always try to tell people. The question is, you know, it really gets you worried because sometimes you can't see a way out. When I read this book, Republic Lost by Lawrence Lessig, about just how much money there is in, I mean, my God, nowadays, when you work as a congressman on Capitol Hill and you're making 120 grand a year or whatever, which gets you nowhere in D.C., by the way. But the cool thing is you can work for 6 or 8 years and then go work at a lobbying firm on K Street and make 5-6 times that. And Capitol Hill's becoming the farm league for the big leagues, which is the companies that actually come in and work for big corporations to make a whole bunch of money. And I don't know, you know, one of the things that Lessig says is the problem is that because government, the way government is structured, this government is structured, or just how big it's become, that's why you have such a concentration of power. I mean, like Palmolive and Colgate-Palmolive controls 83% of the soap and toothpaste you buy in this country. There isn't, what happened to competition? What happened to, why in the world can I not break into the drug industry? What I mean, you know, we have these massive companies. Banks everywhere you look are too big to fail. We're back in the same position. I mean, there's never been such an economic concentration of power, you know. I mean, agricultural concentration of power. Archer Daniel Midlands controls something like 45% of all the corn that comes into this country or that is produced in this country. I don't know what the percentage is. But I just feel as though we are really in a position where not only is government too big, but corporations are too big. And where does it leave the rest of us?
I have to disagree with you. Having lived my life.
But having said that, let me just say one thing. Having said that, Microsoft is in some trouble because they can't make a product that I want in comparison to what's available on Apple and things like that. So everybody has challenges.
Well, back to 1955 and the Fortune 500 companies, not one of those managements thought there was any threat to them no longer existing. And there's only 10% of them left. You've got to ask yourself, why is that the case? To his credit, John Kenneth Galbraith, who wrote some books, The New Industrial Estate, those type of things, when I was my 20s, maybe.
He was a famous economist.
Right? Famous economist. He's a Canadian. He operated the Office of Price Administration during the war, and he had a ball doing it with all that power and so forth. And then he was a Harvard professor, and he was everybody's hero at the universities. But he said that all these corporations create demand. All these corporations manipulate the public. The public is too stupid to know any better. And before his death, he was about 95. I heard an interview with him almost 2 weeks before his death, in fact. And they said, Mr. Galbraith, citing some of these statistics about how there's been a diffusion of power, how new companies have come along nobody ever thought about, how, you know, a company like Yahoo, for Christ's sake, as opposed to ExxonMobil, was the most valuable company. Apple is where all the value goes, where all the wealth is created. These other companies like Procter & Gamble are struggling to keep their margins, and they keep reducing their staff counts and so forth because they've been commoditized. And Galbraith said, yeah, the one big underestimate, the amount of competition in the world.
Yeah, I mean, people with ideas, I just think that we've got to preserve the environment in which individuals get to benefit from their ingenuity and their sweat and their guts.
We're the only country in the world today that rewards that. I'd go through a
list
of
companies.
I know,
but we still have an economy of influence in Washington. It's an economy of influence.
Well, yeah, but that is because government got so big. But you don't have an economy of influence with consumers. Walmart didn't arise because Washington said it's okay. For God's sake, in Benton, Arkansas, Sam Walton had some good ideas about how to use management information to provide the lowest possible prices. So today he employs about 1,300,000 people. And the statistics on that company are just absolutely astounding. But the number of people that benefit from it, consumers, and I, until a year ago, had never been inside a Walmart. Now there is one not too far from where we're living in Utah, and I go there, and when I need something, it's always there, and the prices are crazy low.
Yeah.
And I see people walking around that store that couldn't afford to shop for that kind of stuff, buying that sort of stuff. And it's an astounding thing, but I also go to Target when I'm here in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And it's the same kind of thing, but probably a little further upscale. And as long as they are satisfying me as a consumer with those incredibly low prices, and as they're satisfying employees of them, why should – there are people that say the government should come in. I heard an economist – I debated an economist not long ago about Walmart because they wanted to come into a certain community. And he said, well, they come in and they screw up our labor markets. What the hell is your labor market? Define that for me, idiot. You don't deserve a PhD. A labor market is whatever the supply and demand ends up to be. You've got a lot of unemployed people in this community. They don't have any work. Walmart's going to come in here and provide work for over 10,000. What do you mean your labor market? Your labor market is sick because you don't have enough demand for your labor.
Right.
You don't have a business proposition anybody's willing to live with around here. So Walmart comes in and trains them. You can argue that, well, there are health benefits, but they're not a government organization. When the market demands it, they'll provide all kinds of health benefits. Starbucks, another example. Howard Schultz. You go through a long list of these companies. People look at the Fortune 500, but I've said now, I'll say it the third time, every one of those companies is endangered. The only thing I would agree with you on is that in the large financial institutions, their deposit liabilities are guaranteed by the federal government. Franklin Roosevelt did that. That's an absolute guarantee. You can never go out of business, no matter how stupid you are. And I was part of one of those institutions for 30-some years.
Yeah, but banks are too big to fail, right? I mean, we have what Paul Krugman said, I thought was great, which was, I don't agree with a lot of what he says, but I loved what he said, is that we have privatized gains, socialized losses.
Yeah, but that's not from him.
Oh.
Milton Friedman said that a long, long time ago. Oh. You cannot do that. And that's what they did with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which a lot of your audience may not be familiar with. These gigantic government-sponsored. But I know people and very close friends of mine who were at the senior level of those organizations that were making $4 and $5 million a year because they were privately traded on the stock market. And the stock market said, hey, what a great deal. The government's guaranteeing them. They can't go broke. Well, they finally were so irresponsible and stupid, they went broke, and it cost taxpayers hundreds of billions of dollars. I mean, unbelievable amounts. So when you're guaranteeing the liabilities, you should take over the company.
Right.
You shouldn't let private sector guys go out and rape the benefits of these guarantees of deposits, which, by the way, until recently, the investment banks did not enjoy. the Goldman Sachs.
Well, wasn't that because they went from private partnerships to...
They went to become public corporations, and then they got very big. See, there's all kinds of conflicts here in the private investment banks, just in a soundbite. They became public corporations, but they were run for the executives, not for the shareholders. That was what every decision was made to maximize benefit for the employees, if you will.
Right.
That doesn't work if you've got public shareholders. Mm. So a lot of them went out of business very quickly.
What is your prediction? I know you don't like making predictions, but what's going to happen with the fiscal cliff?
There is going to be a tax increase on people over whatever amount they earn, over 250, 500, whatever. There are four things to be said about it. One, there will be a deal where those people that Obama's calling millionaires and billionaires, this class warfare stuff, they're going to get a higher tax bite. Not going to do anything. That's the second point. Not going to do anything for the fiscal deficit. Nothing.
We won't be able to pay
back. The numbers don't work. The number of people that earn what he calls this threshold, I think, is 250, which, by the way, is not a rich person anymore in today's world. But let's call it 250. If you taxed every dollar they make, and he's running trillion-dollar deficits, you probably have $120 billion a year. You know, this is all political class warfare. But so for that reason, they're going to get higher taxes. That's the first thing. The second thing is there are going to be promises of expenditure cuts that will never come through, never.
Never.
And it's going to be a reflection of how powerless right now the Republicans are. And the Republicans have to think, because remember, they have power in the House. So for every two years, they have to go back to the electorate. And if Obama successfully pulls off this, it's the Republicans' fault. They could lose the House in 2014. Just anecdote, footnote here. The Republicans retained control of the House in this election just passed, 2012, and the average margin of victory was higher than it was in 2010. So what's interesting is the electorate said, we'll reelect Obama by a much, much smaller margin, by the way, but we do not want the House of Representatives in Democratic hands. We want divided government.
Yeah.
So these idiots can't go out and do stupid things.
Yeah.
So that's saying there won't be any expenditure cuts. There will be small tax increases. The issue will not have been solved. There won't be any benefit to it. And by the way, we'll probably go beyond January 1st without a deal. But the Secretary of the Treasury has the authority to maintain withholding tax tables at current levels, which I am sure he will do.
Is your point of view on the world, you've been around 72 years, are we better off than we've ever been, or are we worse off than we've ever been?
We're much better off than we've ever been.
But how about government and the state of our union and our republic?
I could. There's a long speech to be made about that subject. I was at the Army War College recently, and fella put up a list of things we have today we didn't have 25 years ago. It's an astounding list. Everybody in that room, certainly anybody near my
cell phones, internet.
Oh, internet, cell phones. You go through everything to do with information technology. You didn't have any of that 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And I can remember, you used to use pay phones.
It's brought people closer. It's brought parents closer to their kids. It's brought, you know, it's made it possible to experience other ideas and other people. I think it's led to less brutality in the world because these governments like Syria and these regimes.
Women are by and large much better off in most countries.
Yes.
Certainly in the United States.
Yeah.
I have a daughter and a wife, and I had a mother who worked, and I had to live through some of the discrimination that they had to put up with, especially my mother. You can go through health care is miles ahead. We have made enormous progress against cancer in many places. Even people that we call poor today have flat screen TVs.
Yeah, it's true. There is an equality of consumption.
And if you look back and make some comparisons.
But also not to mention the fact that the world is by and large living under, at least to an extent, a representative government.
Yeah, that has a lot to do with it. And we didn't continue going the way of communism. The Soviet Union fell apart, couldn't support Cuba anymore. Everybody saw what a fraud that was. And people realized more than any time in my lifetime, and probably even way before that, that a lot of what they were believing and buying into was imagery.
Well, everybody, you know, this guy, Rory Parker, I think his name is, who's an MP in the British Parliament and a fascinating guy, has walked all of Afghanistan and really had some great... You go to TED.com, which all of you should go to all the time anyway. He gives some great speeches on what's wrong with our current policy in Afghanistan. But he said, even in the remotest parts of Africa, Afghanistan, you know, they're very tribal, they're very isolated. He said, I've never found anyone who didn't want some say in who governs them.
Sure.
I mean, democracy is a human right.
And if they don't have any formal say, then there is a black market in ideas and economics, and it thrives.
That's right.
I still remember when you and I went to the Soviet Union, you were just a kid. One of the drivers with a state car, of course, for a couple of packs of cigarettes, took us all around and so forth. That's what they traded it. But let me point out, the day I was born, Hitler dominated Europe. Nobody doubted he would take over England. The Japanese were on the move in Asia and were knocking over everything in their way. They had invaded and taken over China, all of China. They had engaged in the rape of Nanking. Not that many people knew about it because communications was nothing like it is now, but it was wholesale slaughter. These Tojo and Hitler were going to rule the world, no question about it. And if you go back and look at those newspapers and the radio in those days, there was no hope. It was gone now. We had no chance. No chance. Then what happened, the reason World War II was won is because it unleashed this enormous productive power of the United States. Hitler and Tojo and their allies couldn't even come close to competing. When the United States demonstrated this, when they went into North Africa to throw Rommel and his guys out, which was a very successful operation, every tank they'd lose would be replaced by two. Rommel would lose his Tiger tanks and would have to wait a month.
Well, the one thing for sure that you know, they always say, Francis Fukuyama and some of these political thinkers say, that the end all and be all, and when societies have truly matured, is when they become liberal democracies. When individuals have maximum freedoms and the freedoms that we all enjoy here, the freedom of speech and the freedom, frankly, to get richer than your neighbor does, that is when you've kind of arrived.
Just by the way, I'm going to quickly point out one of the things we're going to realize, like we did about the Soviet Union, is that government cannot deliver the goods. So if you're on the bottom of the social or economic pyramid, looking to government to provide you with the answer to all your prayers, instead of going out and earning it yourself, which is what a lot of people do today, they're going to be incredibly disappointed.
Those are wise words. You
really think so?
Yes, I do. We've been pretty serious here. We've been talking economics and stuff. And you took a tour. You went to Guam. You went all over. You took a tour of the Pacific to go and tour the great battle sites of World War II. And you told a very moving story about a woman who was 90. You were on Iwo Jima. I think they open Iwo Jima one day a year for people to come and see. Explain that and tell us a story about that old woman.
She was actually very spry and in great shape. They gave permission for people to go to Iwo Jima, which has played a very important role in my personal life.
Because
I was in the Marines.
Yeah, you were in the Marines.
And it was where the Marines on a very small island that they had to take, because there were two airfields that were raising hell with our bombers and killing a lot of people. And we needed a place for those bombers to come back when they were crippled under bombing runs in Japan. And we also needed a place. We had to eliminate their Japanese fighter aircraft taking off from there. And it was a terrible battle. The numbers are interesting. The Japanese had 22,000 guys dug in deep into caves. We bombarded it for 72 days. We don't think we killed more than 10 Japanese soldiers.
Why is that?
They were just down, dug into, and I'll get to that in a second. They were down, dug into the island. I've always known about this. By the way, Clint Eastwood's two movies on Iwo Jima are, for anybody interested in recent history, are absolutely required. He shot them in Iwo Jima. There was a famous Japanese general named Kurabayashi, whose grandson... We never found any of Kurabayashi's remains. But let me go back to my numbers. 22,000 Japanese soldiers defending it. 21,000 were killed. 13,000 remains they've never found. Only 1,000 surrendered. The Marines lost more dead in that engagement than any other in their history. They lost 7,029 guys. Most of those they lost in the first week to 10 days of the battle. The Japanese had the beaches completely zeroed in with mortar from the north end of the island and machine guns from caves on both sides. And the first wave of Marines got on shore, and they thought, this isn't too bad, not all that much hostile fire. When the second wave hit, the Japanese opened up. They had all these things zeroed in. It was absolute catastrophe. There were more medals of honor awarded to the Marine Corps on that one battle, February of 1945 to the end of March, than any other engagement in their history or any other one of our armed forces. So, I mean, it was a famous, famous place for somebody who had been in the Marines. You had to have been a Marine to get permission to go. It was very moving on the kind of honors that they provided. There were some actual 80-some-year-old veterans of that action I had a chance to talk to. But here's the story you're talking about. On Mount Surabayachi, I climbed up the same...
Surabayachi, was that named after the general?
No, that's Kurabashi.
Surabayachi
is the island has a little mountain, not much of a mountain, but it's a high ground on one end. And that is where the Marines had that famous raising of the flag.
Yes.
That is now a monument in Washington. And there were six guys that did that. By the way, four of them were subsequently killed. Mike Strang in particular got the Medal of Honor. And he was played by John Wayne in a movie called the Sands of Iwo Jima. Uh-huh. It was a famous, famous engagement. Now, I climbed up the same way the Marines did to the top of Suribachi and saw where the flag was raised. And there were people up there with tears in their eyes. And you were looking down with some of these guys who had actually experienced this, where they landed, and they were pointing out where their buddy was shot down next to them, and all that kind of thing. Then I went down, and I walked along the beach, and I found a 50-caliber machine gun bullet that had been there 67 years buried in the sand. Remember that very few people go there.
Yeah.
So you were finding, and the Japanese still have these 13,000 remains they're determined to take back to their homelands, their hometown in Japan. And so for them, it's a shrine. Now I'm walking.
Does Iwo Jima belong to Japan?
Yes. We gave it back to Japan in 1967.
Okay.
So we're walking along the beach. And I see in front of me, it's kind of tough going. I mean, I brought back all this volcanic ash, and I have it at home. You know, they couldn't get any traction with their vehicles when they hit the beach, the tanks and all that. That was one of the big problems. And I was assigned a Marine. We were all assigned a Marine. There weren't very many of us. My Marine said, and I've never been served so much in my life. I was going to get a tape recording to give you an example of how fathers should be treated. So he said, go down to, I had a shirt and tie on because there was a commemoration ceremony and it was very hot. He said, sir, if you'd go down right at the water's edge and just try to run 100 feet up the beach, which was what your task was. And I did. And you would be running and there would be no traction under your feet at all. And that was one of the things they hadn't realized, how bad that was. Nevertheless, those tough going through that. I see a woman in front of me walking. Now, there were not very many women in this group. We only had one airplane, a 737. And I caught up to her because she was having some difficulty. And I said, can I help you in some way? She said, oh, you're so kind, so forth. So I went ahead of her and trampled down all the high grass and so forth so she could follow. I said, can I ask what you're doing here? And she said, yes, my husband was killed here. And he never came back. We were married 2 weeks before he came. I never remarried, didn't have any children. And I always, before I died, wanted to come back and walk where I think he took his last step as a living human being.
Wow.
And she knew what division he was in. She knew which side of a rock, which is still there, because that was the dividing point.
So she knew he was in that area, somewhere he had walked. And she
walked all the way along that beach, which she had always wanted to do. And this guy was killed 67 years ago.
God, that's incredible. 67 years, she comes back just to...
She always wanted to do it. She finally...
always wanted to do it and finally did it. That's a very moving story to me. You know, people never forget. And it brings me really to, and we'll end this with this, you know, we've talked about being a hero, and as a man, you know, the idea of being a hero is a gun, and you're fighting off the enemy and stuff like that. And, you know, it seems to me, they always say that a real soldier, the most formidable soldier is a soldier fighting for love of country, not hatred for the enemy. You know, fighting for a real ideology that he believes in, that he's willing to die for. And it seems that the United States Constitution and what it stands for, that is a very powerful idea that I happen to believe won the political argument and has always been much easier probably to fight for, because I think when you're fighting for that versus a totalitarian regime, or you're fighting because you were told to do something, I would imagine it certainly makes the effort more worthwhile, and probably brings out more of the hero in a man than would any kind of coercion. I think that it seems to me it would be very difficult for someone to say, you know, I mean, the Nazis had this problem when they were killing Jews and Russians wholesale in World War II, and the young men were these young German men were shaking. They didn't know what the hell, why they were lining people up and shooting them into these. They didn't do anything. And then you'd have someone like Himmler give them a long speech about the glory of the fatherland. That is not sustainable. It's not food for a soldier at the end of the day. You just can't go on, I would imagine. And maybe you can talk a little bit about that, because as I get older, I realize that we talk about heroes and stuff, and there are different kinds of heroes. You know, a hero can change very quickly. You may need somebody with a gun, but when like this Newtown, Connecticut thing, when your child is killed, your new hero becomes somebody who is a grief counselor, your rabbi, your priest, your minister. You need somebody, if you have cancer, not somebody with a gun, but somebody with soft hands and a lot of degrees in the wall. And I just think it's interesting that as you get older, you realize that everything's compartmentalized, isn't it?
I think it's situational heroism. Somebody said, and it was a combat veteran, to me on Iwo Jima, heroism is an accident. It's a question of finding yourself in a situation. And remember, too, that history is written by the victors. And in this case, history is written by the survivors. There were a lot of great heroes who were killed, but there weren't enough witnesses the way they award these medals to be able to observe and later give testimony. There were so many guys killed that there were a lot of heroes, but heroism is finding yourself pinned down where your choices are Hobson, or no, you don't have choices. You're either going to get killed, pinned down, or you're going to take this outrageous thing of trying to get to that machine gun nest and wipe it out. And somehow, a certain number of guys got up there and did that to the machine gun nest, not because they were different than their other friends, but because they were in a situation where they had no choice but to go up and do that. And a lot of their friends that tried to got killed.
Yeah.
So eventually you were going to get out of 7,000 guys killed. And by the way,
you're bringing up a point now that I think is interesting, because we do sometimes, you just used a machine gun nest. That's a very stark example and a very clear and present threat and danger. The challenge becomes in our society and in our life where you have a threat that is way more insidious and invisible. Like, for example, the growth of the state, the growth of government. That is, and that there are things that are happening to us as people in this country, I think, where we're not even able to not only see it happening, but a lot of people don't even know what to strike out at. Many people are very frustrated with the economy, very frustrated with the fact that they don't feel represented by government, but they don't know where what root to strike at. They're just, like Thoreau said, I see men everywhere striking branches and none hitting the root, striking at the branches of evil, but none hitting the root. So it becomes a difficult thing sometimes in a society where you all want to be, men always want to be heroes. I think that's our biggest aspiration. But my God, I don't know who to hit. I'm shadow boxing here. I don't know who to lash out at. I don't know who to connect with.
Well, you're not under threat. Heroes only are produced when there's a clear and immediate threat.
But the threat can sometimes be growing and looming over the horizon. You don't see it until it's too late. It's a tsunami.
I mean, there's no room for a hero on the size of government. I mean, there is room for
I can't
for
go
hero.
In there with my banner.
No.
I mean, you guys are too big.
A lot of people do, but nobody will pay any attention to you.
Right.
I mean, when life is as good as we have it, you're not going to get a lot of heroes. You may get them in sports, and that replaces the war idea of a hero. Guy hits three home runs.
Well, and by the way, a hero can also be somebody who is not the kind of hero that would make a good movie. There are some great heroes out there that spend their time sitting in a room thinking and writing, and that wouldn't make for such a good movie because their weapon is a pen and their mind, and a lot of times those ideas have to take root, and it takes a generation or two or three.
A distinctive person that can do things that are truly exceptional. For me, a hero... This great Greek that John Kennedy first quoted, and he was talking about Aristotle, excellence is happiness, he defined
using all your talents along the lines of excellence.
Using all your powers along the lines of excellence.
Yeah.
That, to me, is what a hero is. People, if you take a look at my grandson here, he's playing the guitar 3 hours a day, but I met a kid his age the other day that plays piano 5 hours a day.
Yeah.
I mean, they're driven by something I've never experienced.
Well, what do you if I had three people in history you could really sit down and spend a week with, who do you think they would be?
I think Abraham Lincoln would be one of them.
Why?
Because I think he changed everything we've been talking about, the whole nature of government, and went through an enormous amount of resistance, hatred to free the slaves. And because of his, he had opportunities to end the Civil War on less than ideal, what we currently consider ideal circumstances. And remember, we're talking 1860s here. And he said, no, the black man has to be a free man. And he won the presidency and overcoming what seemed like almost insurmountable odds. And a lot of the ideas that he promoted and did so eloquently and with a very human touch have surpassed any president. I think most historians would call him probably our number one president.
Who else?
Gee, that's not an easy question. That you need some time to think about. We're not talking about heroes necessarily. We're talking about
just people.
You would have to want to talk, if you could, to Hitler.
Hmm.
There's a lot of questions not answered. For him to have, I would ask him all kinds of questions. I'd say, did you personally order the liquidation of the Jews? There's nothing in writing. You're too smart to ever do that. Every historian in the world has looked for it. Some historians said, absolutely, and we know the day and the meeting he did it and all that. I think he'd have to answer that yes. Remember, you're talking
about... Well, he was a sociopath. I mean, do you think he was a sociopath?
Yeah, everybody has their... But see, the reason everybody has an opinion on him is because he is such a major figure in our history that when I've read two biographies on him, and the second one I read by Joachim Fest, there was in the beginning of the book a picture of his father, who was a postal clerk. And then there was another picture next to it of his mother. And it never occurred to me that Hitler had parents.
That he was a kid.
Yeah, and I mean... See, even Germans today are very, very defensive in trying to explain how this could have happened in the modern day and age. But they almost all, when you discuss it with them, and I met von Ribbentrop's son and others who were very senior in the Nazi administration, how could this happen? Could it ever happen again? Two answers come out of it. It could never happen again. And I tend to believe that. I mean, they all believe that. But number two, it happened because of Hitler. So
I think it could happen again. It did happen on smaller scales in Rwanda and things like that. I mean,
I'm talking about a world scale where he's able to take over most of the world.
Oh, I see. I see what you're saying.
All of Europe.
Yeah, it's a different kind of time.
And this guy,
he was just such a sharp profile. If you guys should watch speeches by Hitler on YouTube to see how dangerous someone who's that theatrical and that passionate was. At the end of the day, he was talking about eradicating.
But it's not only that, and people always say, as I said earlier in this conversation, well, consider the context. They just come out of Versailles. You know, World War I and World War II will be seen as one 30-year civil war in Europe. There was really no distinction between them. The Treaty of Versailles was not sustainable.
What would you ask Hitler?
Pardon?
What would you ask Hitler? I mean, would you really...
What drove your hatred for the Jews to the passionate point that it did? You may have considered them inferior, but you were slaughtering millions of men, women, and children. What kind of a man can do that?
But he wasn't. But I mean, but you might have been talking to a complete, you know, a real sociopath, someone like, you know, Stalin and Mao Zedong, who looked at just a pile of dead people because he had to get rid of a problem. You know, as an actor, if you're playing, it's a terrible way to look at it. If you're playing someone like Stalin or Hitler, a monster of that proportion, you play him as a guy who's trying to solve a problem. If you want to get intriguing,
but
Anthony Hopkins would
do monster. That. I want to see what drove the monster. And the third question I'd ask him is, what were your major mistakes in the war? Because at the beginning of the war, everything he did was right, despite his general's reluctance.
Just as a military
practitioner?
Towards the
end of the war, all his decisions were wrong.
You mean as a military?
By peeling off and going to Kiev instead of going on and taking Moscow. If he had gone on to take Moscow and Stalin had gotten on the train that was waiting for him to take him on the other side of the Urals, I don't think that there was any chance that Stalin, from that position, instead of being in the center,
but you
could have held the Soviet Union.
You've also read a lot about Stalin. Do you fantasize often about being a sniper and taking them both out, saying way before they had a chance to do their damage?
See, my interpretation of Stalin is that he was a thug. In the Soviet Union, and the difference between Stalin and Hitler is, Hitler was in a country that was highly civilized and the arts, and it was a leader in industry. It was a country that almost everybody looked up to, a lot of our people came from. Russia was a bunch of peasants, and they had always lived under
brutal
czars
yeah.
or somebody who had absolute positive.
So Stalin was a product of a system that was going to produce a Stalin anyway. You came to the top when you were a sociopath.
And he was preceded by Lenin, by the way. He gets a lot of the...
And by the way, Khrushchev wasn't much better. Khrushchev said, I have blood up to my elbows. He said that himself.
Well, because of when he was under Stalin.
But what is the difference in... I mean, but Hitler had a racist policy. Is that what the difference is? Or was Hitler just more of a demagogue?
Hitler had a worldview, and it was very well developed, that people that went to visit him would come away mightily impressed, not by his theatrics, because
he believed in a sort of a new world order, kind of like he wanted to create an alliance between not the United States because he felt their racist policies, their policies were gonna, their toleration of the black man and the Jews were ultimately gonna bankrupt and corrupt the country, but he wanted to create an alliance between England and Japan and Germany.
He did think in terms of 1,000-year spans of time. The reason he invaded the Soviet Union, which everybody agrees, was a terrible mistake, taking all those resources and going that way, as opposed to defending his possessions in the West, is because he said, if I don't invade them now when they're the weakest they'll ever be, when do you think they'll invade me? 15 years? 20 years? Do you think we can live on this continent together? The answer is no.
Because he thought that way.
Yeah. I mean, for him, what they had in Europe was not a stable constitutional balance.
Yeah.
And the Soviets had these... Remember what Stalin did. Here are some incredible numbers. Men under uniform, I'm talking about. Men under uniform. The Germans lost 9 million killed. There were a lot of civilians lost. Japanese, 7 million. You ready for this? The United States, under 500,000. Sometimes there's disputes about exactly how many. The United States didn't suffer.
Not the way.
The Soviet Union, 14 million. Because of the tactics that Stalin would use, just keep throwing cannon fodder at him until he run out of bullets.
Jesus. That was more,
you would have expected that out of a peasant, czarist, dominated society that goes back as far as we have history.
So you'd like to talk to Hitler, you'd like to talk to Abraham Lincoln. Who is the third?
A good one and a bad one there. There's so many to choose from, and it depends upon what period of history you decide to. I'll tell you somebody, but he's too early in our time. And I did have a chance to talk to him. He's still alive, and that is Gorbachev. Gorbachev is going to be recognized in history for having made decisions that are unbelievable, including not sending troops into East Germany.
The reason I wouldn't be so interested in Gorbachev is because the end result has not really borne much fruit. It was a phase that, you know, Russia went through, but really...
It was the end of 70 years of total
communist
indoctrination.
Isn't there somebody like Isaac Newton, you think, or Einstein?
Isaac Newton, I wouldn't understand.
That's
or,
true.
Or, you know, you could say Einstein, great scientist. I wouldn't understand them.
Yeah. Yeah. When you,
I had a period of about 2 years, Citigroup sponsored a collection of scientists and economists came together down in Los Alamos, and I was in charge of that. We were spending the money. We had to have somebody there. And every quarter I'd go down and I'd have lunch with these guys. There were three Nobel Prize winners, Phil Anderson from Princeton in physics and so forth, Gene Arthur in economics. And I would sit there at the lunch and I was kind of the host. They would start to talk and I wouldn't have any idea what they were talking about.
Well, what's great about when you hear mathematicians talk or you know, when you hear Einstein talk not about physics, he said he was really mostly concerned with two things, truth and beauty, universal truth and beauty. And then they, you know, because mathematicians, theoretical mathematicians will talk about how much area of the globe a hawk can see at any given time. And then if they fly for 50 minutes, how much of the, you know, how much of a spherical point of view. I mean, they really come up with beautiful
questions. Here was a real live discussion. One of them had been hired as a consultant to determine for some city, maybe New York, I don't remember, how many cars are going to go through the toll booths if we set up these toll booths and charge this amount of money for cars to go on to their expressway. And I would have thought that's highly predictable. It's not. You can't tell. It's unpredictable.
Huh.
And he took us through a number of, but then they got into a conversation on quantum mechanics as it relates to toll booths. I had no idea what they were talking about, but they were all right into it.
By the way, I'm surprised you didn't say Socrates. You'd take Socrates over Gorbachev.
Too far away. It's too far back. Yeah. I mean, we have such...
You are taking now a biology class, and you came up with some really neat things. You can't fold a piece of paper more than 8 times, no matter how big the piece of paper is.
Try to take a piece of paper and fold it over. Say, now I fold it in half. Now fold it a quarter again. That's 2 folds. You can't get beyond 8 times. You can use whatever tools you want. And I think the Mythbusters pointed this out. But far, far beyond that. Theoretically, if you can fold that piece of paper 50 times.
Which you could never do.
Could never do.
You could never fold a piece of paper 50 times. It could never
theoretically,
happen.
If you could do it, how high would that piece of paper be? 70 million miles.
So if you took a piece of paper and if you could fold it 50 times, it would be 70 million miles high, and the sun is 93 million miles away.
75% of the way to the sun.
Now, that's the power of exponential reason. Numbers. That's the craziest thing I've ever heard.
Just take,
why did that come up?
Number 2 to the 50th power and see where you come up.
Well, why did that come up in your biology class?
Very interesting context. Why does it came up? Because we were discussing why does every human being in the world is distinctive, all 6 billion of them, with a few highly celebrated, irrelevant, identical type twin or even identical that aren't from the same womb. Why do we have everybody different? And because
different
got,
fingerprints, different DNA.
Two sets of gametes, without getting into this in any detail, and you've got two sets of chromosomes with 26 genes lined up on each. And it comes out when a fetus is formed. It's a random process. Nobody can predict how it's going to.
It's just the random. The, it's the random power the body, of numbers.
And if you just take the 26, and then you multiply it by 4, and say that what comes out, the specific nature of what comes out, is to the 26th power. It's an almost endless number.
They're looking at with biology. Biologists, you know, like this guy who writes about ants. There is an order to the universe. I mean, certainly to the ecosystem and to our world. There's an order to it. Ants, I think you said, when a colony reaches 90,000.
80,000.
When they reach 80,000, they'll automatically just know to branch off and form another colony.
They form another
how
colony.
Do they know? How do they know that? When birds fly in unison, how do they know that? Do we have any idea?
We still theorize on how homing pigeons work. They've tried everything with homing pigeons. They've taken them away from home, and they've put them inside a cement mixer and turned it upside down all the way so that their orientation, magnetic orientation, will be completely screwed up, almost kill the bird. Take them 10 miles away. Let them go, night or day. Some people think it's all about the sun. Night or day, let them go, and they come back home.
So there's that sort of a universal consciousness among some animals. Where do you think human beings are headed? What's going on with this internet? Are we being nudged toward each other? Are we getting to a point where we're going to have experiences for each other? What do you think? What is your philosophical, spiritual, even religious in your private thoughts, your notion of where you think we're going. What is the point of all this?
I think the spread of knowledge and people drinking in all this knowledge is going to be incredibly chaotic and unpredictable.
To what end?
I don't know what the end is going to be, and I don't think anybody else does either. And all the books written that tell you what the end is going to be. I'll tell you, there's a very good book called The Signal Versus the Noise.
Okay.
And the world is full of noise, but it has very few signals. And if you want to understand what's happening, where things are going, you got to pay attention to the signals. I'm afraid I don't remember the author, but I've just finished it about a week ago. And it's a very, very good piece
Silver,
of work.
His last name is Silver, I think, right?
Nate Silver.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a very good book.
He is the guy who predicted every election, even down to the state level, and his percentage of his margin of victory was almost precise.
Wow.
But wow. He will tell you right
now. Make
the
a good
it
gambler.
It doesn't mean I can predict the future. It means that I've learned how to separate noise from signals. Turn on television anytime you want, and I've always been impressed. What do they fill all their time with? For example, this horrible, horrible event in Newtown.
Yeah.
The TV screens had nothing but that, and I understand why they wouldn't. But if that had not happened, if God had been merciful and that hadn't happened, what would they have their TV screens full of? I mean, the newspapers were full of it all the time. And here is what I discovered. When I was, and I never knew this before, when I was appearing on television a fair amount because the company I was running was in the news, especially financial news, the producer, one of the better-known interviewers, would come and say, can you come down to the studio? And we have a time slot for 10 minutes at some point. You're in show business. You know about this. And I'd say, either I could make it or I couldn't make it. And I found them begging me. And I'd say, oh, okay. And then I'd go down there and I'd do the 10 minutes. And when I'm leaving, the guy'd say, can you come back for a panel discussion this afternoon? Which I couldn't do. What I came to realize suddenly is they have got 24 hours a day.
They have to fill. Yeah, they got to fill something.
And so most of what they've got in there is noise and fluff. It has no substance.
Everything is like that. Life, you know, there are people. The huge part of learning how to live your life productively is figuring out what the minimum effective dose is for anything, whether it's exercise, food, knowledge. Tim Ferriss says you can understand and speak 95% of Spanish if you learn 2.5% of the words.
Well, I think it's true in English, too, frankly.
Probably, too.
Yeah, I'm learning Italian, though, and I find that to be the case.
All right, well, you got to catch a plane, Big Mike. So, as usual and as always, we appreciate your time. Did you come up with I guess you came up with three people. Thanks for your time. Always great. And once again, everybody, I will be in the San Francisco Punchline January 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th. Come and get some. I'm doing a whole new hour and a half. I'm excited. And then I'll be at the Vancouver Comedy Mix January 24th, 25th, 26th. January 26th being my birthday. Don't ask me how old I am. Have a safe flight, Big Mike, and stay American and keep the faith, brother.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/Brian Callen Comedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.